Well, welcome to our second session on technology and temptation. We have, I want to give credit where credit's due. I'm shamelessly borrowing heavily from two resources. Last week, I got a lot of the material from this book by Craig Detweiler. He's a filmmaker and a theologian, so it's like a good combination. And so it's entitled, iGods, How Technology Shapes Our Spiritual and Social Lives. And so our social environment changed was a big theme from last week. This week, I'm borrowing from a social psychologist, you might say, who does a lot of work with generational studies. It's been 25 years. She's a graduate of University of Michigan. And Jean, I think her last name is Twinge. iGen, that's the title she gives to those who are born 1995 and beyond, the iGen. And so, iGen, why today's super connected kids are growing up less rebellious, more tolerant, less happy, and completely unprepared for adulthood. And what that means for the rest of us. So this will be a lot of what we're using today, at least especially the parts that I'm having. This is a collaborative effort. Several of your pastors have contributed to this today. And so I appreciate the flavors that the Lord brings into the mix by having a variety. And so God be praised for that. So quickly, here's a review from last week. We saw that we have, through our changed social environment, easy access to endless abundance. And I hope that stuck from last week. That especially with the coming of the smartphone in my pocket, I have access to endless information. And it goes on and on and on and on. And it's growing exponentially. So, as we consider this, there's temptations that come with it. Worldliness, especially the lust of the eyes. Always wanting to see something new, experience something new. And laziness, which, ironically, or actually providentially, our sermon today was on work. This requires contentment, learning contentment, and it requires learning discernment. Otherwise, we will not gain wisdom, right? These were things we saw last week. Again, if you didn't hear it last week, it's online at sermonaudio.com, SB Academy. So Pastor Rob and I were talking about ways to control and ways to manage having access to abundance, and we thought, well, there's kind of three things you could do. You could either limit the abundance, you could control maybe how much you have out there available. You could control the access. So if you think about it, controlling the access could be controlling your phone. You leave it at home. You leave it on the table at night. Doesn't go to your bedroom, right? You shut it off, or you turn it into a dumb phone. Did we bring handouts for that? We have handouts available to turn your smartphone into a dumb phone, disconnect it from the internet. And so, you can actually control the access point. Or you can control, the abundance through filters, which are not fail-proof, but can be helpful, and other means, right? And so, passwords, a variety of things. Or you could just say, well, I will just be self-controlled. This is where we get an interesting concept of the snack culture. Famously, many decades ago, Aldous Huxley came out with this book, Brave New World, which I would not recommend reading. But the idea is, like, how could anybody resist if they had, like, a pleasure button almost, like just readily, handily, anytime, just plush. You can push the pleasure button whenever you want, as it were, and just make this available. And you think, a smartphone's in my hand, and the button is right there. How many can resist? One person, Nancy Miller, in a cover story in Wired, describe this as snack culture. snacking is portable and bite-sized. Pop culture, this is from the book iGods, pop culture was repackaged with the iPhone in mind. Our news, information, and video feeds were reformatted to Apple's specifications. I think the difference between a full-length movie and a YouTube video or something, right? So Nancy Miller described it as snack culture. The endless buffet of music, television, games, movies, fashion. We now devour our pop culture the same way we enjoy candy and chips. In conveniently packaged bite-sized nuggets. Made to be munched easily with increased frequency and maximum speed. This is snack culture, and boy is it tasty. Her words, not to mention addictive. Craig Detweiler added, thanks to the iPhone, quoting from another professor, we have evolved from a culture of instant gratification to a culture of constant gratification. So you don't have to go to the table and sit down for a meal, which is bigger and requires preparation and you wait for. You can carry your pleasurable food with you at all times, at all places. So imagine if we just handed our children just bags of chips or chocolate in the morning and just said, now don't touch this until noon. This is for dessert. And how many of us would have confidence in that, you know? How many of us would be able to resist that, right? Not just children. I mean, it's a temptation for all of us. And so Detweiler adds, there is the constant temptation to relate to the iPhone rather than our world. It is a convenient filter for screening calls, keeping colleagues at a manageable distance. It provides a safe place to hide when we're anxious in a crowd. We avoid awkward moments by fading into our phones. It prompts us to look down rather than to look up, to ask Siri for answers rather than our friends, our parents, or our God. The iPhone is our most valuable possession and our closest companion. It records our lives, broadcasts our photos and thoughts, and serves as our traveling studio and electronic megaphone. It lives up to its hype. And now Pastor Rob's going to talk a bit about self-control.
I just have this. I know he's going to show up. Joseph's going to show up any minute and interrupt to tell me I have to go. but, yeah, self-control. I'm glad you said, you know, we're talking about maybe the younger people today, but my goodness, self-control is not a young person's struggle, okay? And we think about how Scripture talks about self-control as actually being one of the fruits of the Spirit, which that's probably the one that has always intrigued me most. The more the Spirit controls you, the more you will have self-control. And because we have the urges in us that are saying, I need, I want, I must, and the ability to say no to our flesh is an evidence that God is controlling our life, that we can actually say no. So spirit control means self-control. And in our best moments, we do want to please God. But when we face temptations, when something is presented to us, when we get the opportunity, all of a sudden our best intentions begin to crumble. You know, I'm not going to eat this, but if someone gives it to me, then I feel like I got to eat it. You know, like I was fine until someone showed it to me. And that's the way it is. And access and abundance was last week. You know, access and abundance. Well, again, it's intensified when you come to the internet for some kinds of temptations. And self-control is something we should be learning how to do. It has to be taught to us. We have to learn. In Titus, older men, younger women are all told to be self-controlled. I don't think excludes older women. Just saying those are the three it mentions to be self-controlled. And it urges younger men must be urged to be self-controlled, Titus 2:6. Here, go real fast. I'll just end at this point, and then you can decide how you want to handle when I leave. But let me just say this. Don't do it is not teaching someone to be self-controlled. I mean, that would work for none of us. Stop it. Just stop it. Not necessarily helpful. We need to come alongside and encourage and teach and exhort someone to have self-control. First Peter says at the end of all things is at hand, therefore be self-controlled and sober-minded for the sake of your prayers, which actually will come up interestingly enough. What you're going to say. Make every effort to be self-controlled. I'll end with this proverb and then I'll take my break here. A man without self-control is like a city broken into and left without walls. Interestingly, a man without self-control is a city like a city broken into and left without walls. People had walls around their city because there was danger, people wanting to come in. And that was the whole point. Last week, one of the things we said was, this isn't like having a smartphone is not like having a calculator. Okay? Someone designed that calculator to keep you using it. But someone is designing all the things your phone does to keep you. They're keep trying to like scale the walls. They are trying to scale the walls to come in. And so if you don't have self-control, it's like a city where everyone can just keep on flooding in. So it's a necessary protection against them. I gotta go. All right.
He's a man under great self-control here. So. I want to add something onto that. Even though self-control is a gift of the Holy Spirit, the New Testament does not say, great, you can then face every situation. I think of, the struggles that I had as a young man with lust, and it was pivotal for me to realize I was not supposed to fight it as much as flee from it. Flee immorality, flee youthful lust meant a lot to me because it gave me the perspective that this is going to be overcome primarily through cutting off the access rather than thinking I can just face the temptation and I should be spiritually strong enough to live up to it. Most of us need to recognize we are not, even when the Holy Spirit is available, we're probably not at that spiritual maturity spot yet to face that on a regular basis. And so as Peter in the garden was told, pray that you enter not into temptation. The spirit is willing, your spirit, Peter, but the flesh is weak. And so controlling that access point is actually, this is the point at the beginning, self-control is not going to be the answer primarily on this. The self-control is going to be exhibited in controlling the other two points, the access and the abundance up front, rather than to try to control, say, that open that wide open, and it's okay. Let me just give you an example of this. When I was designing curriculum for Spring Branch Academy, early on I had the choice of having Adolf Hitler's Mein Kampf. Others recommend giving that to high school students. I read it a little bit and was like, there is no way I'm going to send a 10th grader off all by him and herself to listen to Adolf Hitler with nobody else around. And yet, by just handing a smartphone to our youth with no guidance, parameters of access and abundance, it's not just Adolf Hitler. It can be anybody they find interesting and go listen. And who knows what they're going to come to conclude. I mean, do you follow what I'm saying? To have a smartphone in a room, in a bedroom, all by oneself, in today's world means I can have access to anybody in the world, and anybody in the world can have access to me. That's what that means. And that is a definitely changed social environment. That is radically different. So, let me just talk then. We got three topics. talk about hyperconnectivity, characteristics of the current generation that's up and coming, and then virtual reality versus real presence, you might say, social real presence. How many of you remember the pager? How many of you hated it when it first came out? I feel like I'm on a leash. I used to hear that, you know, I feel like I'm on a leash. You know, and that's kind of now become passé because everybody has a leash, you know. It's like you're expected to have the leash, right? You're expected to be connected. If you're not connected, people think you're dead. You know, it's like, you didn't answer my text, you know, I thought something happened to you, or like, you know, my phone call, or... So we're, Detweiler's words, we're always available, but we're rarely present. We're always available, but we're rarely present. Personally, this has a personal effect and it has a relational effect. The personal effect on me personally is I am being constantly interrupted if my smartphone is on. Constantly interrupted. It's interesting. Last week we talked about a myth, one of the brain myths. The one that talked about brain development, you know, it peaks at age, it's not, the brain's not fully developed till age 25. That's actually a myth. Brains like muscles can be developed earlier if used and exercised, especially through trying circumstances. And this is a generation that is coddled and sheltered, and so it is not being developed with those kind of circumstances. And so, of course, in a sense, it's developing later. But multitasking is also a myth. Not only this book, she did brain research, postdoctoral work, but another book I had read last year said the same thing. Our brains are not wired to handle more than one thing at once. One author called it, what we're really doing is switch tasking. We focus, then we focus, we try to focus and focus. And so it create. If this happens a lot, what it does is it creates a sense of crisis in our brains and gives us feelings of anxiety. And so constantly interrupted is actually increasing the anxiety that we feel as we go through the day. The average teen, if you just put it in perspective, the average teen today, this book came out last year, checks his or her phone over 80 times a day. And that's not too much in one sense, given about 16 hours of about, I think, 5 times an hour, but in a variety of circumstances, that's the average. The relational effects. Here's what Detweiler described that. He said, devices designed to organize our schedules have made us busier than ever. Families have fragmented along technological lines. Maybe you can relate to this. Nights that used to be spent gathered around the fire gave way to the radio. That's a long time ago. And then television. Before splintering now into individualized screens, we inhabit the same space but follow our own feeds. We have an iPhone in our hand and buds in our ears. And how can we hear God or each other amid the din, he asks. So, there was a quote in college by Jim Elliot, the famous missionary in the 1950s to Ecuador. It struck me in my college years, because I was not doing this. He said, wherever you are, be all there. And that stuck with me even to this day. Constantly reminds me, if I'm here with somebody, not be thinking over there about what I wish I was doing or want to be doing soon, right? Give that full attention to that person, honoring them with that full attention. One of the stories in the book was of a 13-year-old that grabbed her friend's phone and threw it against the wall, so frustrated because you're not listening to me. I thought, wow, if a 13-year-old could be frustrated by this, others of us can as well. I just want to add here, I mean, love is not rude. It may seem like a minor thing, but love is not rude. It's rude to constantly interrupt somebody when they're giving you something of their own heart and mind and then constantly checking out and being over here rather than honoring and giving that attention. This is another one that's interesting. Having this connection now also prohibits us from developing independently of our parents. Maturity requires freedom. We're going to talk a little bit about maturity. The freedom to make choices and the freedom to fail. And then have to work through, what do I do now, right? But with a cell phone, and of course a smartphone, and texting away, our children are never, ever truly away from us. They can always contact us in any situation. They don't have to think through it anymore. What do I do? I'm on the side of the road. What do I do? They can just text us and find out. And so how many, in a sense, actually leave father and mother if in virtual reality we know we can always contact them at any point? This is something to think about as far as for development. Of course, it works the other way, too. Parents often are helicoptering, you know, checking out on their children. I know I got reproved for this when I, you know, because I fell in. I was like, I'm not hearing from this or that child. And I'm like, where are you? Where are you? That child let me know. I'm old enough now. You know, you don't have to keep checking on me. And that was a good reproof to my heart, you know, that you're right. Third, it can also hinder a healthy relationship with God. So if it hinders me personally through distractions and interruptions and hinders me developing, not being disconnected from my parents in a healthy way, it also hinders me in my relationship with God. My relationship with God also requires focus and concentration. Pastor Rob read that verse from 1 Peter 4, verse 7. Sane and sober for the purpose of prayer. Prayer requires full attention, concentration. We have Jesus' example on this because being connected through a phone is maintaining your connection with a crowd. A whole network of people, right? Social networking. I am available to the crowd at any moment. Jesus gives us the example. I have the verse up there, and there's others. Luke 5, verse 16. Jesus would withdraw. That implies would often withdraw to desolate places to pray. In the same context of the Gospels, it tells us needy people, people who needed healing, were searching for him and couldn't find him. He withdrew so well, they couldn't find him easily. Now that tells me, if Jesus is okay with needy people not being able to find him, in order that he could give his full attention to God, his Father, then it's okay if I, personally, if others have a hard time getting a hold of me from time to time in order that I can focus on my relationship with God and pray. Your friends need to know there are times when you will not be able to get a hold of me. Let them know this up front. Don't think I'm dead. Don't interpret it that I don't care about you. I have to do this because my relationship with God requires that I give it some full attention. So I have to be able to turn the phone off so that I can pour out my heart to God in whatever elation or tears or earnestness or even anger so that I can give it to Him and not be interrupted. If Jesus had to do it, I need to do that. Does that make sense? When we had Paul Patton, Dr. Paul Patton here speaking on Proverbs, Pastor Wally told me one of his favorite phrases is a media fast. He teaches communications. and taught that, and having a media fast. Sabbath was for the purpose of God, right? My relationship with God. That's my utmost relationship. If I'm dishonoring my friend in order to honor God, it's actually right. And I shouldn't feel bad in that sense about it. I should love everyone, love my friends dearly. But my time with God is, that's important. Okay, so let's talk about some characteristics of the current generation. By the way, you're all a generation, and the sociologists love to group you in groups. Generalities are okay. Don't think I'm like prejudiced, stereotyping, anything like that. Do you know the Bible actually generalizes? Titus, the book of Titus talks about Cretans and their general characteristics. Okay, we won't go into that. It's not pleasant. But just, there's characteristics about people groups. Not everyone, but in general, there's characteristics. And so, if you're 70 or older, you're of the silent generation. I don't know why that got the name that. Then there's the boomers. And then I think those born in the mid-60s and on are like Gen X. And then there's the millennials. And those born 1995 and beyond, about that age, mid-90s, are iGen. And she, Jean, Dr. Twin, she noticed that the statistics didn't vary as much on many things from the Gen X to the millennials. There was more gradual trends, but there were sharp changes with the iGen generation. And probably the largest, biggest phenomena that changed socially is the introduction of the smartphone. It radically changed not just our environment, but our children and how they relate to each other and how they're coping and dealing with life themselves. And so here's three traits. Number one, there is a radical individualism in our youth. Now, that's not all that new, but it is accented. By individual, there is a deep, deep sense of a person should be able to determine their own life and with nobody else telling them it's wrong. This generation has a really, really hard time telling somebody they're wrong. Spring Branch Academy students, some of you are aware of a video that I show taken on the University of Washington's campus about with the gender thing. You know, if somebody thinks they're a woman and they're a biological man and all that kind of thing. And so the interviewer goes, what if I told you I was Chinese? And the college students look quizzically, well, that's okay for you, I guess, if you want to think you're Chinese. Or what if I'm 6 feet tall, 6 feet five, and the guy's really short, you know, or 7 years old. And it really puts them back on their heels, but they have a hard time. They can't just come out and say, well, you're just wrong. And so because it's just built in them that you give everybody the equality, everybody the space, to determine this for themselves. So, this is one of the reasons they suspect that young people of this generation predominantly voted for either Bernie Sanders or Donald Trump, which on the surface would have little to do with each other. But both of them portrayed themselves as individuals, not in the system. And the appeals to the youth individualistically being that way. So here, listen to a Republican who's 18 and a Democrat who's 21. The 18-year-old says, I'm a Republican and a conservative because I value each individual taking care of themselves. I think that's absolutely the most fair way. Everyone gets out of the system what they're willing to put in it. The 21-year-old Democrat said, I am a proud liberal Democrat. I don't believe we should steer people into doing anything. We are free to be whoever we want to be as long as we're not hurting anyone in the process. This is very strong value in our youth. Notice both of them think they're being very different, but they're bringing to the table the very same value in that individualism. And so the author of the book actually said there's one party that brings these together, and that's the Libertarian Party. It's probably most representative versus the traditional polls of the up-and-coming generation. The idea is, quote, get your laws off my body, my stuff, and my guns, and let me do what I please. And that mindset, other than, please pay for my college student loans. The big exception, with childcare as well. This one is, the second one here, safety. This one is really interesting, and it's actually something we all need to think through this again. Who's raising this generation? You know, we who are parents need to really think through this. Our kids, in one sense, our youth today in this generation, in one sense, are more safe than they used to be. They smoke less. They drink less. They date less. They have sex less. And they hang out less. The only exception is they're actually hanging out more with their parents. Now, they do think smoking marijuana is more acceptable than they used to in past generations, but because that is perceived as not being dangerous. And yet, even so, with that acceptance, they're not doing it in their teens as much as they did in the, say, 70s. Safety is a dominant value in the iGen generation. We see that in our college campuses, the kind of riots and different things, the disinvitations going out, the safe places wanting to have places, which is unthinkable for those that were on college campuses in the 1960s. You know, to think then the students wanted to be recognized as adults. Now the students want college to be a home. And rather than confronting those with differing opinions themselves, they're more frequently calling on the administration to do something, as if the administration are the parents in the situation. You need to do something about it and create a safe environment for us. It struck me as I was reading through this that there's actually a similarity between a young person's view of safety and a young person's view of rules. I had a conversation with a college student just this last spring, and she was saying, you Christians are always talking about freedom, but I don't see freedom. You have all these rules. And she was not saying it critically as much as she is very open to the gospel. First time she'd ever read the Bible was this spring. And so she's like, what about that? And I said, you know what? If I handed you a guitar right now and just said, play anything you want, completely free, no rules, you'd be like, you know, strumming, I don't know what I'm doing, you know, but I'm free. No. If I constrain you, right, through rules, say, no, play it this way again and again and again and again. Pretty soon, if you get constrained up front, in the end, you're empowered to play anything you want. Because I'm training you wisely to live in the way you were made, right? That's what the law of God does. This is how you were made. And so the gospel frees us from our sin, empowers us by the Spirit to then fulfill what the law required, to live as we were made to live, which is real freedom. And so they think freedom on the surface is the absence of rules rather than the empowerment, right? The empowerment to be fulfilled in doing what you're made to do. Safety is now viewed as the absence of danger rather than through discipline and training being given the resilience and wisdom to handle hard situations, temptations, and difficulties. What's going to make a child safe in the end when they're 30, 40, 50 years old? Is it constantly protecting, keeping, and avoiding danger? Or is it to be empowered with character, God-given character, by the Spirit and wisdom to face difficulties and challenges? Now, the book didn't talk about this. she's maybe not in favor of this. Why do we not spank as a culture? Because I would never hurt my child. But the Bible says it's the opposite, right? To spare the rod is to hate my son. Why? Because the Bible is clear. Discipline your son while there's still hope. And do not desire his death. Even the Son of God, Hebrews says, learned obedience from the things which he suffered. Even apart from sin, human development needs pain. To protect and keep a child from pain completely is to basically destine them to being weak and vulnerable and unable to handle the challenges and difficulties of life. And it begins when they're young. The Bible is clear. The rod and reproof give wisdom. And so embracing that, recognizing that, that's what's going to make them safe, if you want to think of it. The fear of God in the end. Does that make sense? Third, and this follows, interestingly, from the others to some degree, especially the last, this generation is very immature. Again, as a generalization, my generation, I'm a Gen X. Lengthened adolescence into our 20s. Adolescence is the time when you have an adult body but a child mind. So that's kind of what it is. Now, this generation, though, has lengthened childhood into what used to be adolescence. Today's teens, as I said, are less likely to date, to hang out even, to drive, or to go out at all without their parents. In 2015, more than half the sophomores had not driven at all. Permit, nothing. 28% of seniors in high schools did not have a driver's license, many not even wanting one. Half as many seniors work today as in the late 1970s. Few of those who don't work are given allowances. Used to be you were given allowance so you could at least learn to manage money. Allowances are now have largely gone by the wayside. After 2000, 20% of our high school seniors had no money of their own at all to manage. Parents basically bought things for them. Get a load of this statistic. In 1960, for a young woman, the median age of marriage, median means line them all up in the row, count them up, who's the exact middle, what age are you? The median age of marriage in 1960 was 20. That means half of them were married in their teens. Okay? By 1975, it had bumped to 21. Well, in 1995, it was 25, and now in 2015, it's 27. For men, it moved from age 23 to now age 29 for the median age of marriage, first-time marriage. 32% of 18 to 29-year-olds, these are in their 20s basically, in 2006 were married. Now, get a load of this, 2014, 4 years ago, only 16% of that age group was married. More of them lived with their parents than with a spouse or a live-in partner. Isn't that interesting? More, even. Not just discounting marriage, just even having just somebody, you know, living together, which is not biblical, not pleasing to God, but... And so... We have today more young people that are truly single than previous generations. So here's what she concluded. 18-year-olds now look like 14-year-olds. This, if you work with young people or college students, you need to be aware of this. This is very enlightening. It's really helpful. 14-year-olds now look like 10 or 12-year-olds used to. Childhood is lengthened, with teens treated more like children, less independent, and more protected by their parents than they once were. And she says, college students markedly scored higher on maturity fears not wanting, it's called adulting, taking responsibility for your own finances, laundry, things like that. And in fact, college admissions personnel are reporting an increased use of college students identifying themselves as kids compared to what they did when they used to admit people to college. The strike, probably the statistic that struck me the most was regarding those not educated at college, young men in their 20s, 1/4 in America do not work at all. The entire year of 2016, 1/4 did not work. And if you throw in early 20s, college or not college, 1/4 of our young men did not work at all that year. Those are years of should be of strength, of great fruitfulness and productivity, of development, and we're seeing an extension of childhood. So the question comes in, well, if they're not going out, if they're not dating, if they're not working, what are they doing? You know, it's like, so what, you know, what's going on? And the answer seems to be they're on their phone. Almost all the undergraduates at college that she interviewed slept with their phones or had their phones nearby. It was the last thing they looked at night, the first thing they checked in the morning. They're texting, doing social media, they're online, they're gaming. These things are called new media. Here's how much time is being spent. Statistically, now this is just average. I don't know how much it applies to this group, you know, because we're in a different location than the rest of the country, but here's what it is statistically. High school seniors spend an average of 2.25 hours per day texting, 2 hours per day on the internet, 1.5 hours a day gaming, and 1/2 hour on video chat, which is a total of 6 hours a day in the new media. Talking on the phone is now 45 minutes per day. 8th graders are spending 5 hours a day on the new media. Social media is now almost completely a requirement if you're a teen. Girls do it more than boys. If you're a boy, video games are a lot more of a temptation, as well as pornography, of course. But it's interesting, the statistics on video games are either they do it a lot or they don't do it much at all, is the way the statistics show up. So, with regard to video games, 9% are doing over 40 hours a week. 27% are doing less than an hour a week. Averages out to 1.5 hours a day in gaming. So, let's just pause for a second. I know it was brought to my attention. It's like, well, gaming is gaming. I mean, if you're playing basketball for 6 hours a day, or you're playing video games for 6 hours a day, I mean, why should you put down one versus the other, right? And I was thinking about that. It's like, I'm not sure playing anything 6 hours a day is a good thing. When you're a young person that's been given gifts and there's needs in the world, and so the verse that came to my mind is 1 Corinthians 13, when I became a man, and Paul's just using it as an analogy, when I became a man, I gave up childish ways. It kind of struck me as odd last year when I started seeing, or a couple years ago, at Spring Branch Academy, coloring books. Did that strike you as odd too? There's adult coloring books. Call adult coloring books. You know. But shouldn't we get beyond coloring books? You know, to like, there's challenges out there to face and fruit to bear. So, Rob, would you come up and just share about thoughts on gaming?
Sure.
Would you be willing to do that? You got it there?
Yes,
I got
do.
It right here. If you need it.
Okay.
Yeah, it's not something I have lots of experience with, but just talking with others who have. I talked to somebody who lots of gaming experience. I said, just tell me some thoughts about it. And this is just their what they came up with, and I thought was helpful. Just thinking about time. I mean, you kind of just went to it. 6 hours a day doing anything. And just so remember that we want to make the best use of our time from Ephesians 5. And social associations. It's kind of hard for me to say. If you're playing social video games, in other words, you're playing other players in the world. It's literally what you're doing. It's like people who are very much into those certain games, you're playing others in the world. And it's a social activity that you're interacting with, or they're interacting with, they're communicating with, they're talking, so maybe through through typing, or they're actually like verbally communicating. And so you realize your child then is talking to anyone. You have no idea how old they are, where they're from, or what they're saying. And guess what? They're saying anything the world would be saying. So don't just assume, oh, they're just playing a game, or they're chatting with other kids online. That's not what you should assume. Someone told me a story of a video game for little girls where you like become a little fox and you run around and you are little something, cute something. And they do things. Apparently I'm not familiar with the game. But the point is you like they take on the character, you're playing this part, and this person looked at like they must have looked at the profiles or something of this you think a little girls game. It's like 50% girls and then like another like 40% older women, but like 10% were older men asking questions like, tell me about yourself. Like, so you think it's just a little game for girls, but there are older men who are preying on little girls through a simple game. So you just realize you're inviting someone into your home to spend time with your child if you allow them to do that. And realize that we don't want to be imitating evil. That's a good general principle. And so many games are imitating something you wouldn't want. You just think of the violent games, for example. You know, do you want your child to pretend killing someone where you get to see them die thousands of times? Consider that. And so those are just some things that I think I would, as a parent, be like, I don't really know what's going on. But for some people, gaming is a big issue, and you want to be careful of that.
It's interesting. My brother was a grad student at Regent in Virginia Beach, which is Pat Robertson School, grad school. And his roommate was a Republican and supported a local Republican race and was in the program, but got arrested. The FBI or whoever was tracking got arrested because of preying upon minors through online. And that was quite a shocking experience for my brother to realize that was going on. Do we know when somebody's virtual, do you really know who they are? Is there any way to like gauge and taste as we know them by their fruits? Is there a way to really vet that out? My daughter, I remember, was talking to a man in India through Facebook, claiming to be a Christian and all this stuff, and I was like, we can't have no way of verifying anything this man is saying. Nothing. He's on the other side of the planet. You need to stop this. So if our children are doing it with their friends, then that's different, right? That could be vetted and known. And then it could be managed and controlled with how much time and things there. Yes?
A couple of things with those last two characteristics. iGen is the first generation of things we built into life before September 11th.
Okay.
And that feeds into a lot of these issues around safety. You know, most other countries across the world are much closer in geography to groups with which they have conflict. And so at least more somewhat understood in society that there is a chance of that happening here. But that has, you know, very specifically shaped the generation because people are like, I gotta protect my kids. This knows what could happen again. And then the immaturity thing. It's just, if you look at as generations have had less children, you have maybe two kids in the house. A lot of times it may be one up, so you have parents, it's much easier to revolve their whole life around the one or two kids they have, and as the expectations for college are, you're involved in 1,000 activities, then their children are choosing to spend all their time shuttling kids back and forth to activities. And so you have, they are around each other more, and you do have this kind of intertwining of the things they're doing that's harder. So to have kind of this distinct identity, because the parents buy more basically. They work all day, and then they just shuttle their kids to stuff all night long, and that's every day of the week. So it's just, you know, cultural changes that, you know, you see what happened with the boomer generation, and your kids reflect itself.
Yes. Yep, that's well said, Chris. Thank you. One passage that came to mind as I was thinking about this is in 1 Timothy 5. I believe in the power of the gospel for salvation to anyone who believes. I believe in that power. But it's interesting to me, God did not, even in the church, does not place all the emphasis or the expectation of result on mere word. Church discipline, for example, is expected, right? As a part of the process of making us mature and sanctifying us. So God relies on the inner word and on external circumstances, the rod, you might say, externally, and reproof through the word, correcting our bad thinking, both as a godly, as a father to develop us. So, this passage regarding younger widows, there's a list in the church where younger widows wanted to be on the list so that they could devote their whole selves to serving Jesus. And Paul said, don't allow them to go on the list. They're going to want to get married again, for one. They'll not be able to keep it. Celibacy is a high ideal that often is hard to keep. And his church history bears that out repeatedly. But what's interesting for this talk right now is the second reason Paul gives, which is a very practical one. If younger widows are put on the list, they learn. This is really interesting use of the word. They change. They learn to become idle. They learn to be idlers. In other words, if they don't have duties and they don't have responsibilities, they'll learn idleness. And not only idlers, but also gossips and busybodies saying what they should not. It'll go from being misusing time to misusing speech, finally to indecent speech and indecent communication. And that's really interesting because, in a sense, having a lot of time on your hands, with an iPhone in your hands, our women, God made them to be more prone towards, from the get-go, speech and communication often, as a generality, it becomes a misuse of that. And so, Paul's solution was, I would have younger widows marry, bear children, manage their households. By the way, that's a really neat Greek word. It's the word despotes. Get our English word despot, like a tyrant ruler. But I mean, I'm talking about manage that household, you know. It's like, don't just let things slide, like take control of it. And give the adversary no occasion for slander. This, if you read the pastoral epistles, this last one tells us, our social behaviors as Christians either enhance the ministry of the gospel in evangelizing an area, or they damage the ministry of the gospel. Evangelization in an area where a church has been planted is largely dependent upon the behavior and conduct of Christians, whether Christ gets a good name in the area or not. I don't think it would be wrong for us to encourage young people to get married. If the Apostle Paul sees that, you know, not being married in your 20s is going to tempt you to learn idleness and tempt you to then misuse speech, and with the smartphone, this becomes really easy to do, being distracted and isolated in that hyperconnectivity, I don't think it would be wrong for us to encourage young people to get married and make steps in that direction. If they're not ready yet, make steps. What's the next step? What's the next responsibility? It might be buying a car. And how do we get there? What kind of a job do we have? Rather than sheltering and saying, I don't care if they live with me the rest of my life. That's not commendable. You know? It's like, no, I want to see you live your life, have your own family if God wills, and raise children to the glory of God and fulfill your calling in ministry. Now we got one more topic, and this one is sobering. I have some anecdotal knowledge of this that I'm not going to share, but it resonates with me, what I'm going to share, with regard to the virtual versus real. Statistically, we have a crisis on our hands in our culture with this generation. The irony of it is, even though they're more prone to value safety, and in some regards their social behaviors are more safe, not going out as much, not partying as much, not doing this as much, they are more at risk, ironically, being isolated, lonely, depressed, and not uncommonly suicidal. It's interesting, the United Kingdom, Great Britain, now has a ministry of loneliness, I've heard. The actual government has that. In Japan, there's a whole, I forget the name, there's a whole class of young people now that under that high-pressured society didn't make it and live in a room and never leave it. And their parents put food outside their door. And the church is actually ministering to them when their parents die. Because at that point, what do? Now, those are extremes in other parts of the world. But teens who spend more time on screen activities are more likely to be unhappy and vice versa. The author of this book, iGen, says, there's not a single exception. All screen activities are linked to less happiness. Now that's odd because remember we talked the snack culture. It tempts us to thinking happiness is in my palm. All non-screen activities are linked to more happiness. She says, if you were going to give advice, she's not a Christian, if you were going to give advice for a happy life based on this graph, it would be straightforward. Put down the phone, turn off the computer or iPad, and do something, anything, that does not involve a screen. Teens who spend more than 3 hours a day on electronic devices are 35% more likely to have at least one suicide risk factor, and risks start to increase with two or more hours a day and go up from there. In 2015, one-fifth of our girls reported experiencing a major depressive episode. Many ER visits are caused by girls cutting themselves. Between 2009 and 2015, the number of high school girls, and I emphasize girls because it's affected girls more than boys, number of high school girls who seriously considered suicide in the past year increased 34%, and the number who attempted suicide increased 43%. The number of college students, and I'm quoting this from the book, the number of college students who seriously considered suicide jumped 60% between 2011 and 2016. In the 1990s, suicide rates had declined. They were stabilized in the 2000s, and now they are rising. Among 12 and 13-year-olds, from 2007 to 2015, twice as many boys and three times as many girls. So she asks, why might smartphones cause depression? Here's some of the responses she gave as she thought about it. One is, unlike face-to-face communication, she says electronic communication often involves a delay. You do not get an immediate response to your text. Social media causes anxieties, and girls are often prone to overanalyze what this means. Many iGeners say to her that their online lives make them feel as if they're walking a tightrope. Cyberbullying, if you spend most of your time online, that's not a thing to be ignored. 34% of those online reported cyberbullying in 2016. That's a third. Emphasis on body. Of course, girls are very body image conscious often, and if they're young teens are very insecure in that. Having selfies and different things like this puts pressure on that side of life as well. And then when you throw in girl drama, having hyperconnectivity means I don't leave it. I can't just walk away from it in that sense. And it's without the context of facial expressions and gestures. And so the author says, the perennial teen girl question, is she mad at me, is much harder to answer on a smartphone. Now that she's speculating and trying to think through those things, right? But the statistics are the statistics. Something is causing this. Think about this. Even though our young people still yearn for impersonal interaction, they have less social skills now to be able to do so due to less practice. In the 1980s, our high school seniors spent 6 hours per week at a party. Now they spend 2 hours on average. And often these are run by adults, like a birthday party. Why would they party less? Well, there's no need to be bored. There's Netflix, one teen said. Teens who get together with friends every day has been cut in half in the last 15 years. Now think about that statistic. Teens who get together with friends every day, the number of that is half of what it was just 15 years ago. Among college students, 4 hours less per week spent in socialing, 3 hours less per week in partying since the late 80s. That's 1 hour a day on average of less socializing face to face. Nearly 20% of our high school seniors do not go out with friends at all in a typical week. That's 1 out of 5. Don't spend any time with another friend during a week face to face. There's an extreme amount of loneliness. It is tempting to think communication is communication. If it's a text, I'm hearing from my friend. What's the difference going to make if it's face-to-face versus if I'm texting? In the Bible, we actually have differences being talked about. It's not a proof text, so don't take it as that, but 2 John 12, and it's in 3 John as well, says, though I have many things to write to you, I do not want to do so with paper and ink. But I hope to come to you and speak face to face so that your joy may be made full. It's interesting, joy got thrown in on that. It matters how we communicate something, not just what we're communicating. I mean, it's famously in the past called the medium is the message or the metaphor, but it matters. Choose your means well. Virtual is not the same as presence. A virtual presence and a virtual friend cannot hug you. They can't give you the holy kiss that the Bible talks about, right? When somebody dies, do you want just words? It's interesting. We are embodied beings, and our God Himself became flesh and dwelt among us. And we ourselves will be raised from the dead bodily to dwell with Him someday. Somehow, we need to, God help us to realize the value of showing up in person, looking somebody in the eye, seeing the tears, and embracing them, and encouraging them. We have a challenge ministerially on our hands as a church. There will be increasingly awkward and lonely young people coming up in our midst all around us who are very needy, who will require a lot of time and will take a lot of energy from us. God help us to be able to minister to them, patiently walk with them, seek their development along lines of encouraging changes in behaviors in response to faith in the way God designed us and made us. God grant us to do that. And so I'm going to leave the final word to Pastor Rob here to say what's on his heart. So thank you.
Lest I forget to say it, I made copies. I don't know if I made them. I made 60 copies of the questions that I said last week at the end. And I definitely think you should take it home and talk about those questions with your family. And likely they'll be difficult questions to talk about. I also want to say two pieces about self-control that I didn't say. We talked about the snack culture and carrying it around with us all the time. If someone were to give you and put before you a bowl of whatever you liked and said, you have access and abundance. I'm going to add two more. You have, it's free, affordable, and anonymous. No one's going to know that you're eating it all day or whatever it is. And so whatever it is with you, you have to recognize it's beyond just access and abundance. It's anonymous and it's free. Most of the stuff that is becoming a danger. So, and I feel like you probably sense in us like urgency and like concern and a slight alarm. Good. All right. I don't mean like, and we're not picking on any particular, every generation has their tendencies. So, I mean, as I see younger people here, you should be thinking, oh, they're saying we're lazy and we're this. It's just every generation has their pieces that their culture has brought into their life that shapes them. And so, and I'm grateful overall. I could give personal examples of almost everything that's been described in my personal 20 years of experience of just working with people. So there's nothing that you said that wasn't like, oh, I don't know someone. I know someone of all those categories. But I am grateful overall. I sense that our church probably is doing a better job than average in these areas. So I'm grateful for that. I'm grateful when I don't see phones. I'm grateful when I don't hear like certain things as part of the conversation. So that's good. Guarding our hearts. Have some words on this. We've heard the Proverbs 4:23, above all else, guard your heart, for everything you do flows from it. But Proverbs 23:6 says this, my son, give me your heart, and let your eyes observe my ways. That was really interesting. So it's not like I'm just telling you, like, oh, come on, guard your heart, everybody. But a father saying to his son, give me your heart. Like, I want to help shape your heart. That's an awesome verse. Observe my ways. And so, parents, asking yourselves, what do you want to flow from your child's heart? Or young men and women, what kind of man or woman do you want to be? No one says, I want to grow up to ignore my kids. But that's what these technologies have the potential to do. No one says, I want to grow up and be looking at pornography when I'm 35. No one says, I don't want to be able to concentrate very long. I don't want to be able to read a book because it's too hard to concentrate. And like, none of those things are at all jokes. Like, they're not jokes. And you are older, you recognize you didn't like become a different person when you turned 23. I mean, you probably spent your 20s, like, still, like, figuring out how to deal with who you were when you were a teenager. Like, you're still working through that stuff. You don't just, well, I'm an adult now, and now all of my childish patterns go away. It's perhaps likely that if you're 45, you're still dealing with the patterns you had when you were 17. So just recognize, you don't just all of a sudden, poof, become a new person when you reach a certain point. And I'm going to kind of go back, parents and youth here. Do you remember, parents, what it was like to be a teenager? You should try to remember. You should try to remember the temptations. Could you imagine what you would have done had you had access, abundance, and anonymity, and whatever the other A was, affordable sin to pursue? I wouldn't want to think about that. I was doing just fine on my own without all the access and abundance. Okay? And so think about that. And just telling them, don't do it, is far from insufficient. It is isolating and frustrating to the child. Parents, you're the primary influence. Like, they should learn about life. No, I got to get to that soon here. From you. Young people, be responsible for your life. Don't be afraid to ask for help. If the boundaries you have aren't good enough, ask for better ones. It's not a sign of weakness. That's the thing, too. Asking for help is a sign of maturity, not a sign of weakness, no matter what age you are. If you are 55 and you struggle with these things, it's not weak to say, I need help. That is strength to say it and to ask for it. And we tend not to ask for help because we don't want to humble ourselves, or we think we can stop, or we think I can change on my own. Whatever parameters you come up with for yourself or for your family, make them public parameters. Don't make personal ones. That's why Weight Watchers exists. Because they don't just say, well, just here, we'll send you the things and you'll probably be fine. They say, no, you have to come in. You have to, you know, we have way, you know, we're, you know, weigh into all these pieces, because it's not a private, this is, you can't grow in this privately. Isolate ignorance versus innocence. I want to talk about that for a second. We don't want ignorant children. I don't want children to not, or teenagers to not know the things in the world. I'm looking for, but I want innocent ones. I don't want them to be exposed to everything in the world. And so, you know, some people might retreat and say, I don't want my kids to ever see a computer, and I'm going to make sure that they're only playing for 6 hours a day, you know, outside every day, you know. I don't want to hide them. That would be wrong. But I want to preserve innocence. And I want to... Are you coming up after this? Okay. I want to just listen to Proverbs 5. You can look at it if you want. It's Proverbs 5. I want to listen, us to listen in on this conversation, because I think it'll be really helpful. I might just need to say, read Proverbs 5. Okay? Really, go read Proverbs 5 and listen to what I'm going to tell you that it does. He starts off, this father having this conversation. It's really a rich conversation. He says, there's something, son, out there worth striving for. Verses 1 and 2. And then he says in verse 3, and there's temptations. In this case, an adulterous woman. And he says, there's temptations and sin. And guess what, son? They're going to taste good. You're going to like it. You're going to want it. You should say that to your kids. You're going to be facing things that you're going to want to do. They're going to taste good. Number 4, but sin leads to bitterness and lostness. Tell them that. And then he says in verse 7, pay attention to me. That's a good, like, middle of the conversation thing to say. Are you listening? Pay attention. And then verse 8 and 9, he says, he warns him to stay away from even going near the temptation. Don't go walking past the house. And that's, here's the thing. He doesn't say, oh, there are no houses. Like, there's no adulterous woman out there. He says there is, they are out there, and don't go by them. So again, he's not leaving his son ignorant, but he's trying to preserve his innocence. So I want my child to know where not to go. I just don't want him to look in the windows. All right? And then he says, verse 11, you'll suffer because of your sin. 12, you'll regret your sins. Verse 14, you'll be ashamed. And then in verse 15, for a while, then he talks about the goodness of wisdom. Or we could talk about the grace of Jesus and the goodness of the of Christ and the greatness of his gifts and of his blessings and of sex in particular in this case. That's a really important one. We talk to your kids about it. It shouldn't be all no. That's not helping. It's no when you go to this woman's house in the Proverbs, and yes when you have it here. That's what the whole Proverbs goes. The dad says, it's really good. Let me tell you all about it. All right? So it's okay. You should be telling him all about it. And so that's helpful. That's helpful. So parents, just in general, be proactive and assume you're probably not being proactive enough. I know some of you may be, but don't just assume I probably need to talk a little bit more than I am. Generally speaking, that's true. Honest with your own temptations, parents. If you need help, statistically speaking, there are people in this room looking at pornography this week. That's just the way that it is. So, young or old, someone needs to be coming. We don't get people coming that often as they it needs to be happening. So please, we would welcome that conversation. And open with your children. Just be open. It's a great thing to be. And to youth, most of you need to be more honest to say, you know what, I probably don't have a good control. Even if you're not looking at pornography, I need to be able to say no to this app. Like, I need to limit my number of friends. I just need to be able to say no and be able to articulate and know this is not a great decision. This is where I can pull back. And humble. All of us, none of us, if you're a young person, you are not wiser and smarter than the very smart, well-paid people who are working all the time to get you to want to keep clicking. You're just not smarter. None of us are smarter because there's a whole team of them just focused in on you. I watched this week as I looked into this. I learned that they will actually cater to you individually on alerting you. Like they'll learn how, like on Instagram, they'll like save up the notifications and they give you a big burst if they see that's how you like. They just cater it to you. So it's not like you just get alerted every time someone does something. They'll delay it to give you like a bigger satisfaction. And they cater it that way. So just that's what's behind it. And be hopeful. All right? Things don't have to. In lots of ways, I rejoice in the many things that I've seen at Countryside overall. Like, I'm glad for a lot of things. But I also know all of these things are represented here. It's some, maybe it's only, for one of you, it's only one of the things. Just be cautious of that one thing. And be hopeful. It doesn't have to be like it is. But it will be unless we like decide we're going to deal with it. We're going to talk about it. And we're going to take this tool, which in some ways we say is neutral, but in some ways it's not. It's a little different than the things of the past. And adjust it head on. So it's time to go. Definitely go back and read Proverbs 5 if you have children and write down how they talk. Not just what they say, but how he says it. And do and have these conversations. And I'll put the questions on the table here that if you're a couple, just take one. Just make sure there's enough for everyone. And young people, I'd like you to, everyone to take the questions. I'll pray. Father, we're blessed, Lord. But we have also said with that abundance of blessing requires us to be cautious because of our own sinful nature of how we will handle blessing. Or we can go back and look at Israel, and just because things got easier doesn't mean things got better for them. And we live in a world where we love things to be easy and we love to have lots of it. And it will require us to be more vigilant. And I praise you for the many blessings that I see at our church, at least. I'm grateful for the wisdom that I've seen in many people, many parents, even youth, Lord. I've seen lots of wise decisions made in this area. That's great. But I pray that would continue and that we wouldn't be fearful, but we'd just be vigilant about these matters. and know that you are, your grace holds us up along the way, and you will supply all that we need in Christ to deal with this well and wisely. So help us, Lord, in Jesus' name. Amen. Any questions? Ask.